they didn't really have a product, and their goal is to solve all of problems. And I find that, and basically the notion was, well, this is new technology that will give us the ability to do that. And that's just not true. And I think that fuels, unfortunately, a lot of the skepticism on the ROI on AI.
Welcome to the AI Advantage, where modern leaders decode the future of tech. I'm Solomon Williams, founder of Solenox. So here, it's no noise, no hype every week. Sometimes it's just me, and sometimes it's the brightest minds in tech, breaking down what it really takes to grow smarter with AI and automation. Let's dive in.
Welcome to the AI Advantage. I'm your host, Solomon Williams. We have a special guest with us today with Noah Bortz. He's the co-founder of HappyPath. So Noah, thanks so much, man, for taking the time. Really excited to have you here. Just, you know, tell us the audience just a little bit about yourself and a little bit about what is HappyPath.
Yeah, Solomon, so glad to be here. Happy to jump right in. So yeah, my name's Noah, co-founder. HappyPath, I mean, the whole goal of what we were trying to accomplish was to solve testing for everyone. And what that looks like, I guess, is very different depending on who's listening to this. For us, when I speak we, I'm talking about myself, Eli Schlonsky, and Harry Keith were the three co-founders of HappyPath. But we all came from trading, essentially building trading applications and trading platforms for, you know, different firms across crypto and traditional finance. And so what we found while we were in that journey was that we hired some amazing developers. Myself, I was a product manager. Eli and Harry both were engineers. At times, Eli was a product manager, but was still forced to do engineering work. And we really found that there were amazing engineers that we were hiring. They were coming out of, I mean, what was Fang. I'm not sure if it even exists really today anymore with the whole change of the Mag 7. But incredible engineers who knew very little about finance. And so we'd write up what we thought was exquisite product documents, at least we were under the impression, only to find out during testing that requirements were built incorrectly because contextually there was no understanding of what we were trying to build at a very deep level. And the, I guess, communication styles and subject matter expertise, that kind of gap between someone who was on the desks versus someone that was trying to build this behind a keyboard was really, really massive. So when we started HappyPath, that was the goal. The goal was, how do we gap those two things? How do we, you know, and that was one approach. And the other approach was really from Harry's perspective, who I have to say is like the brains behind the operation. His perspective was, I'm really tired of writing Selenium scripts, and I just want something that will write my Selenium scripts for me. And so he woke me up 3 a.m. It was like a Tuesday, late 2020, if I'm getting my dates right. I think I am, yeah. And so GPT-3.5 hadn't come out. So ChatGPT hadn't come out, for people who maybe don't know all the model colloquial terms or the model terms. So 3.5 hadn't come out. He woke me up at 3 a.m. He was like, hey, I built this, I guess what we would call now an agent. But at the time, he was like, I built this robot that can just execute off natural commands. He brought me into his room and he'd set it up to buy a pair of AirPods. And so he put buy a pair of AirPods on the command line. And essentially just began executing through, going to Google, searching AirPods, finding the site, executing. It is now, it was, I guess, operator, OpenAI's operator, or Anthropic's computer use. It's what that looks like now. So it was like the first form. I don't think people really focused on agentic purposes for LLMs, but that's what he was showing me. At the time, I had absolutely no idea what he had written or how it was built. So I was like, I'm going back to them. I don't know why you woke me up. The next day, though, he sat me down, and we were roommates at the time, me, him, and Eli. And we really spoke about, like, what if this was the entire process for testing, both from my perspective of being able to test what my engineers on my team were doing as a product manager, and for him being able to execute through tests more seamlessly without having to write specific Selenium scripts for all the different use cases for a specific platform. So that's where it started. And from there, we started writing what now is our patent. At the time, we called it the sauce. That was just the name of the document, and essentially outlined how HappyPath's engine to date currently works. Many things have changed, but it was a good framework for it. And so we started, we really formalized what that the sauce document was. We built a business plan around it, went out and raised, and then, you know, things changed. We became a lot less focused on trying to solve the world's problems and a lot more focused on trying to solve a very specific niche problem. And so today what we're really focused on is in the world of technology, there's a huge piece of technology implementation. So for example, with enterprise applications, and this most people have heard of, things like SAP, Oracle products, Workday, usually the company you're at uses it for something, maybe HR function, maybe you're in manufacturing and it's used for manufacturing, maybe for finance. You know, NetSuite's a very common finance platform. And we realized there's this massive gap. When we looked at all of the industries we could try, the niches we could really dominate in, we noticed that consulting still operates with Excel spreadsheets, manually, people clicking through platforms. I know this because I actually started my career doing this at EY. And we realized we can solve this. And we can solve this problem actually for the entire industry and really begin to dominate. And so that's where we're at now. You know, our main focus is automating. We're rolling out a solution for Workday shortly and hoping that we have a second platform out in 2026.
Love that, man. And so on the sauce, I'm curious, I like that sauce framework of what you were kind of mentioning before. So how do you think that how that has evolved as HappyPath, you know, grew and, you know, you see what were like those major pivots that they made along the way to now get to this point. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. I would say that there were two large, I don't know, like we're supposed to use good framing and good words, downfalls, pitfalls, problems, hurdles, obstacles. There's so many different words to describe it. We've, you know, persevered past it now, but it's hindsight's always 2020. The first one was education, both ourselves and the public. So initially, I think we had a lot of the misperceptions that many people have about LLMs, which sits on one or the other. We sat in one camp, but there, I think there's two major camps. It's one, it's a farce. AI is a complete farce. LLMs aren't going to be able to accomplish anything. All these investments into AI, it's going to, you know, I don't know what I can say on this, go tits up. And, you know, bleep it out if you need to. But it's going to go tits up and, you know, it's a waste. We shouldn't even spend time on it, right? That's one camp. I often have found when I speak to people who are sitting in that camp, it tends to be people who have been engineers for decades who just are very kind of set in their ways. And the idea of a truly revolutionary technology, maybe it's scary or maybe they've just seen this happen before and, you know, they don't get them on the bandwagon so quickly. The flip is AI can do everything. You know, and it's the individuals who basically say, okay, I use ChatGPT and therefore I've optimized my company and this is what LLMs are, or everything can be solved with ChatGPT and I don't need to hire engineers anymore. We're seeing a lot of that in the news of people basically just wiping out their engineering forces, which, I mean, I'm on a tangent here, which we can delete off of this podcast, which is just
love it.
It's not true. And I think the great fallacy is, okay, if I go and write all of my code, it takes me longer to write it, but I don't need to reread what I wrote. If I have an agent like Cursor build out all my code, as someone who's non-technical, I love Cursor. But if I'm a technical individual using Cursor, I actually have to go back and check everything it did, every change it made, because at the end, I need to understand all of the code and how it's interacting with each other, as well as whether it's calling to other platforms or different aspects of the repo. So, total tangent on that. But those are the two camps, is AI can do everything, AI can't do anything. And we sat in the AI can do everything camp. Oh my God, these LLMs, this is such a breakthrough. And there wasn't, you know, if you go back and it's 2020, there's not an enormous amount of documentation. We weren't talking about it. It was not, when we came out and we were pitching for our seed investment, this was a very breakthrough concept of utilizing agents to execute through enterprise platforms. Now, much more common knowledge. We don't talk to people and they're like, well, I don't even know what you're talking about. But back then, it was like that. So we sat in the camp of, if you read the first version of the sauce, it was basically like, and then we'll pass it off to the LLM, and then we'll get back exactly what we need, and that's it. And like, it was so high level and eventually, you know, transformed and became significantly more in depth long before we got into raising. But during that process was the education of realizing that it is a fantastic technology. Its ability to infer is very valuable. From visual model perspective, its ability to essentially take regressive differences is very valuable. But it needs a lot of support. And as we wrote in the final section of our sauce document, you need to reduce things to simple questions so you can get simple answers. The orchestration can be supported by traditional code. And there's a wonderful piece, and I'm going to try to find it for you for this conversation, called Dracula's Paradox. It was written by our CTO. And the concept, basically, it outlines the idea that, you know, some people believed that it could be a one-shot win and it couldn't. And it was basically speaking about all of the lessons we've learned in how iterative LLMs can be and how much you do really need to work with them. But that was like hurdle number one. Hurdle number two was the false sense of security and infrastructure, I guess, is what I would call it. So when you build an application, and for people who don't build applications, you don't really think about this. You're like, okay, I'm going to have someone who codes it, and then we're going to host it, and that's it. And I think that because we have wonderful services like AWS and a variety of different platforms to compete with AWS, we really have forgotten how hard infrastructure was before AWS came around. And so now we are seeing the emergence of a new form of compute almost, where there is a whole new sense of having to build that backend infrastructure that doesn't necessarily exist. So we were ready to release. We really felt on top of the world. This was probably late 2024. And then we started to scale up and scale out of basically testing just locally into more of a how our customers would be using this, which is on, you know, 1,000 to 10,000 times scale of what we do locally. We realized that a lot of infrastructure collapses and in a variety of different ways. Tokens per minute, you overuse on that. Just DDoSing the actual underlying application and ensuring you actually put in the parameters on the flip side, that you don't hit requests against an application so intensely that they shut you out. Both of these things were lessons learned. And really, even for folks who spent years, I mean, we have probably combined like 100 years of experience at our firm, building applications, complex data-heavy applications, even we kind of have always been able to rely on these pre-existing infrastructures. And so this has been a new challenge for us, is being able to intelligently build with the understanding that infrastructure is going to do this over time, but we're right here, you know, we're at the bottom. So that would be obstacle number two.
Yeah. And I think, like, as you said, just come from my experience, because I'm kind of in similar thing of having to do with cloud engineer, cloud architecture of like now, like of the back end of the infrastructure as. And I think, as you know, you're hearing with all of these data centers that are popping up with the tokens and so forth, that there needs to be a back end, or that the, you know, the data lakes, you know, the having the data warehouses to be able to on a business level. But I'm curious, man, on that side. So with it towards, as you're seeing the 3.0 as the SaaS framework, is what you want to call it, the scaling, where do you see like the industry trend right now as it's going more towards? So whether that's with the clients that you're having now, or just kind of like thinking ahead as that co-founder, what are you seeing as we progress more and more with this AI?
I think there's a number of trends. So the first trend I would call out is, I believe, massive valuations, and we don't sit in this camp, but massive valuations have been proposed for people that did not have real products. I mean, there's a handful, but I don't want to create enemies by listing out discrete names. They didn't really have a product, and their goal is to solve all of problems. And I find that, and basically the notion was, well, this is new technology that will give us the ability to do that. And that's just not true. And I think that fuels, unfortunately, a lot of the skepticism on the ROI on AI. So one of the trends I think that is happening and will happen is both in what VCs value, but also in the trend of how companies are being started, will be much more focused to how like Happy Path is. We're very focused in a very specific niche to solve a very specific problem. We adopt the entire problem set. And it's not like we've created a generalized agent that you can use for 1,000 different things. There is like, use Happy Path if you're implementing platforms, because we're going to automate your testing aggressive, like in an aggressive way that's never been done before. But if we came at it and produced, and there are competitors of ours who did this, who came out at the same time, and they said, we're going to solve testing for everyone. And what happened was, the coverage they have isn't high enough, so people don't use them. And so within our specific industry, and I think our industry can be used almost as an example to the broader market, which is this isn't the end-all, be-all, you know, silver bullet solution. You have to actually create something that has very incredible value, potentially for a smaller group of people. And that's going to be the true ROI. You're going to get actual ROI on that because you're targeted, you're focused, and you're not just trying to shove AI down people's throat. You're trying to solve the actual problem. Happens that you're leveraging this technology.
No. Yeah.
So that's one trend. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of rabbit holes to go down when it comes to trends within the AI world, the pace of innovation. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. Right. No, I think that's good because, you know, you kind of think back onto as it is, like the AI is so broad. And I think, as you said, I think the market is getting towards, is getting really understanding. I'm like, okay, what are the actual tangible outcomes that's really providing for it? You know, what are, without getting into the whole hype of what you said earlier, just on, you know, it can fix everything or it's going to eliminate all jobs and, you know, all the parts. So my question is just, that's on the external side. Do you think for the internal, for your team, like, what do you see, like, generative AI, like, changing the way your teams, like, collaborate, how they across the engineering, the QA for quality assurance and the product itself for your team?
Funny enough, I mean, we're an AI shop who leverages AI, but very carefully. It's not like we, internally, we haven't been fooled into believing we can get rid of our engineering force. So, like, the tools we use to collaborate, to operate, they're not involving AI. A lot of the solutions that we're trying to come up with, either A, have never been solved before, or B, it's coming from like deep inside of a thread of a deeply technical conversation that's happening like on Reddit. It's not coming from like a prepackaged AI tool. You're not going to give us information that people who have been in the field for a decade, decade and a half wouldn't necessarily know. I mean, we use it like probably any other general consumer uses it. Search up information, fact check my friends, that kind of stuff. I don't think it really changes anything. In terms of trends, though, to kind of bring it back. So HappyPath, very specifically, we stated when we came out, visual models were not very good. And visual models have gotten significantly better. So I see that as we continue to progress, while our core engine is focused in our proprietary DOM decompiling algorithm, which I guess for viewers, I will quickly explain. There are, if you ever right-click and click inspect on your page, it shows essentially the document object model of any given web page. We utilize that to classify and understand what page we're looking at. Very kind of similar to the way that a visual model is taking a visual representation with XY coordinates to determine what's going on. A lot of the times we're dealing with platforms that are so complex, you are not going to see everything that is actually you need to interact with. Now that could be like, very easy way, purchase order screen has invoice line items that run off the side, right? And there's 20 fields that are not visible that you need to be able to interact with. When we started, visual models struggle to be able to adapt and understand the dynamic nature of enterprise platforms. I truly believe that with the release of Google's newest model, that we're actually really making some serious progress there. And so as we progress, we will try to integrate that where we can. But at the end of the day, it's not a commitment to the type of technology. It's a commitment to the end result. So whatever delivers the highest performance is the choice we make. It's got nothing to do with, you know, like what we have done or any principles. But I do think that that is, from an internal perspective, something we're going to change. And that's a trend that I'm seeing more holistically.
Yeah. No, I love that, man, on that side. You know, I'm curious on to kind of change a little bit to the, you know, the current state. You know, I know after, you know, from HappyPath, you know, you've secured the funding, which has been great. You know, what have you seen as it kind of moving forward? What has worked really well that you've seen so far for your team, for the business? And, you know, what challenges are you seeing now on scaling? And, you know, how are you navigating that?
Yeah. So I think I may answer your second question first and go back to the first. So in terms of your second question, what, in regards to scaling, the hardest thing is actually not a technical problem, though I do want to touch on technical scaling because we have actually, in my opinion, solved that. The hardest problem is people. You're building something green. You're starting from scratch. You have very limited bandwidth and you're trying to work against tight deadlines. It becomes very hard to train. I think our team does a really extraordinary job at taking extra hours out of the day to work with new engineers. I usually, when I sit down for like the final, because I'm usually the final sign off on a lot of our engineers, my conversation is the first 90 days will be terrible. It will get much better. Do not expect that the first 90 days will be representative of your entire experience. You know nothing about our platform. There is an extraordinary learning curve. A lot of these technologies you probably never interacted with or used in a professional environment. And so just prepare yourself. Even if you're doing something very small downstream, for example, parsing of the DOM, you need to be able to understand all the consequences that happens from what you're doing. And therefore, that kind of learning curve, the first 90 days, I say, is very, very difficult. So that's like scaling, probably the biggest challenge. But I want to be clear, I do not think we are unique in that fashion. I think every startup in the history of startups has faced this. And so it's like just a known thing. From a technical scaling standpoint, we faced our scaling issues about a year ago, or 9 months ago, I should say. We solved it by leveraging kind of a concept from trading. Granted, there are better names for it now. So in trading, at institutional trading shops, and this is just a fun fact, there's this concept of smart order routing. Smart order routing is I place an order and I want to make sure my order fills in the most optimal or economical way across various markets. That same concept essentially happens with LLMs. So if I am maybe nearing my tokens per minute max, or any kind of limitation on any given model set, or there's a specific set of models that are better to accomplish a very specific task than another one, we essentially built this platform that analyzes what task it is and creates fallbacks, right? So big part of our scaling was we were hitting singular LLM, all the calls were going to the same place. That's going to cause 403s or just errors, overloading. And so it was, how do we diversify that? And then how do we diversify that enough also by not just what models we're using, but what providers are hosting said model? So for example, we usually directly go to the model provider. For any listeners that may not understand what I'm speaking about, I will at least clarify just a little, which is that we will usually go directly to Anthropic, directly to OpenAI, but there are other tertiary or third-party systems that will essentially create incredibly stable uptime, like Amazon or Google Vertex. And so leveraging those platforms to basically create a really wide network of different ways we can hit it, that allowed us to scale. And then it was basically that, and then monitoring concurrency. So we are a testing platform. Concurrency is important. If you give us 1,000 tests and want to run them, I want you to be able to click run, close your laptop, and go to sleep. I want you to wake up the next day and they need to be done. If they're not done, our concurrency isn't high enough. So being able to kind of fine tune that concurrency level, because also if it's too high, we DDoS the platform and then we get nothing done and they have a ton of issues and fallout that comes from that. So it's really a balance. Those are the two elements that we struggled with, but at this point have overcome with scaling.
Yeah. Yeah. And like you touched on it, man, even with you bring on new engineers, because even with, I remember like as an architect, as a cloud like engineer, when you come on, it's just, you have to go through like Confluence or like you have so much of documentation just to go through. It's like you're drinking out of a fire hose, right? Of just trying to place on it. It's, you know, and then where do you place into actual work? Can I provide the value on understanding like the KT, the knowledge transfer, all of these things that add in? So I think I love that kind of like you're thinking of that and how you've alleviated that. I think that's where it parts in terms of utilizing the AI and utilizing you guys' own that help alleviate that. Because like, as you said, I think every startup, every small, like, you know, even with larger enterprises still have to deal with that, you know, with knowledge and everything else. So I'm so curious on like you know, it kind of brought it back and looking at yourself as a leader, as a co-founder now, like you kind of shifted over. You know, was that an easy transition for you? Like now coming into like being this leader now, if you're having a whole team of you thinking forward, was there some, I guess you could say like you're a training montage to help you get to where you are now? Or did that just come naturally to you?
No, I credit it all to my mother, which is a hilarious response at this age to do. But I really do have to credit to her. Shout out. Yeah. Moms are always the MVP.
Always.
I shouldn't just say my mom. My parents were incredibly supportive in basically letting me pursue all of sometimes my incredibly stupid entrepreneurial ventures throughout my life, and not just on my family in a whole. And that has led me to a place now where it was very comfortable starting this. The most uncomfortable piece I'll get to at the end, but I'll explain kind of more contextually. When I was in high school, I started a herbal cigarette company called Herbellos. Almost got me kicked out of high school, actually. And the idea was to help my dad quit smoking. He was a heavy smoker at the time, doesn't anymore. So it wasn't successful, though I wish I could take credit for that. That was actually the birth of my niece. But a heavy smoker at the time, I really wanted to quit. I came up with an alternative that I thought would at least, you know, fix the oral fixation, maybe subside some of like the nicotine addiction. And it took off and it was quite successful. And my mom set it up as a legitimate corporation, and we got office space, and I hired all my friends to pack these cigarettes, and I would sell them at bars in town. I lived in Stamford, Connecticut, where there's a whole street, this main street, and I would literally go there and prime target very drunk people. They'll smoke anything. And I got to the point where it, you know, got in the newspaper, got a lot of traction, got my college acceptance offer. My mom said, I hope you enjoy this experience, but for you to take it to the next level, you need $250,000 as a minimum distribution contract with any kind of real distributor. You don't know, have a way to get that money. Go enjoy college. This isn't it. And that's what she said to us. This isn't it. And went to college. I met Harry. Harry lived across the hall from me. We became fast friends. I also met Eli first few days. Eli, I don't think, was thinking about really pursuing something. For Harry and me, it was like, this was the end all be all. We are going to start our own company. We are going to be our own boss. I think there are a lot of 17, 18, 19-year-olds who feel this way. And so I empathize with that. It's exactly how we felt. And Harry and I, at the time, started essentially just like talking about the idea, oh, we should do something. It'd be really fun. It passes. Now, for some context, I worked for my cousin's catering company for about 5 years prior, from a waiter to a cook, a dishwasher. I did all the different activities as a catering company. And at the time, they were trying to staff at about 2,000 part-time staff folks. And they were trying to, so 2016, and they were trying to staff using Excel spreadsheets and email. And it was chaos. And so Harry and I built a proposal for my cousin. The idea was for something called QuickShift. And QuickShift was essentially a scheduling platform for distributed workers, right? So instead of the like Seven Rooms, where Seven Rooms, I know we use it for reservations, but restaurants will use it for, hey, this is when your block schedule is, you need to come in from this amount of time and it's going to be every day. How do you handle it when there's tons of locations with tons of different people? So he built this. It's actually how my cousin ran his business for a little over half a decade. So in my opinion, a huge success. And we really struggled to get it off of the ground, because when we started getting real traction, so it was such a success. My cousin was like, let me invest. Let's turn this into a real business. We got 3 months of traction. COVID hits, the entire industry collapsed, and there wasn't really a future for QuickShift. Funny enough, before we had started that, my mom, who happens to work in venture, she works for one of the largest venture firms in the world, though I will leave that out just in case she doesn't want me to talk about it. She looked at us and she said, this isn't it. And that was even before we failed. I was like, you don't know anything. I know better. I always thought I know better than her. And so we really pursued it full speed ahead. And she was right. The market wasn't there. VCs wouldn't touch us. Our TAM was too low. There was 1,000 things wrong. We had a consumer base that hated technology, and you were trying to sell technology to them. It's just not going to happen. And I'm sure that maybe the industry has changed, but at least a decade ago, this is what it was like. Then Happy Path came to be. My mother's on our board and was one of the initial investors. And this was the first time that she really was like, this has the market. This will solve an enormous problem. This is a problem that permeates everywhere. I see it. I've experienced it. She's had a career that's lengthy enough to know of implementations, knew that I came from implementations, Harry came from engineering, felt that this really meshed and worked. And to a degree, she has been right. This has been it. But through all those experiences and getting the support through those experiences really was the reason that being able to start this as like, we're doing it again. It didn't feel like, oh, I'm doing this for the first time. Now, being a couple of years in, having a full team, having an office in Midtown, kind of like accomplishing all the dreams that I think I set out when I was 17 to want.
Yeah.
Now there are times where I am like not 100% sure what to do. Mm-hmm. But, and I think that co-founders, founders are often too, I don't want to say cocky, maybe you can bleep in a better word, but no, too arrogant, whatever it may be. But yeah, the truth is that now at this point, now I'm surrounded by people I trust and I don't need to have all the answers. And I think that maybe if there's a lesson I can teach everyone is you don't, you need to find the right people. And that has really been my skill set. Like I helped raise the money at Happy Path. I helped found Happy Path. I have helped design the product because I was a user. But at the end of the day, it's bringing together the people we have here that has made this successful. Without them, that's it. It's an idea in a living room with a whiteboard and that's it. And so I have not struggled. When I do struggle, we have just in a true village almost to support us, whether it be advisors, employees, C-suite, investors, et cetera.
No, I love that, man. And in terms of that, really the growth side of just what you stand to, you don't need to always have all the answers. And I know just especially as a fellow founder, like as a, you know, you as a someone in leadership, you sometimes you want to think that you need to know, have all the answers and so forth. So I'm curious on like what Noah brought about like that realization that it's like, I don't need to know like everything or the challenges you face with the clients that it's okay, you know, and that's part of the journey. What I'm curious on that revelation, how you came across that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I would say it's very interesting. There's like so many different things that have taught me this, like every humbling moment in my entire life. But the biggest one has to be so I am a New Yorker at heart, born and raised in the suburbs. And boy, oh boy, are my family like New Yorkers with the very terse, almost thick skin and aggressiveness and all the other stereotypes you want to layer on. I'll accept them all. I went to school in the Midwest and a lot of the guys that I founded this with are from the Midwest. And for anyone that has been to the Northeast and is from the Midwest or vice versa, it is a different culture. And yet those with very different approaches have great success. So for example, I am very direct as an individual, as a business owner, as a friend. Doesn't matter how you know me, that's who I am. And Harry, who's my co-founder, is the opposite. Very indirect, passive. Yet we both had great success in very different, you know, aspects of our life. We've achieved it in different manners. And I think that is a great tell to life, which is just like my experience. I went to school in Miami of Ohio, in Southwestern Ohio. Most of the people I was around was not from the Northeast. Funny enough, I gravitated, of course, to a lot of friends who are now, you know, from the Northeast. But it taught me that, you know, there's many ways to skin the cat. There's many ways to accomplish a goal. And that in itself is such an explanation to like the grander view of like, you don't know everything. Your approach isn't always right. Sometimes taking a step back and looking, listening, hearing out what other people have to say is the right move. And that doesn't necessarily mean don't value your instinct. I think valuing your instinct, for someone like me, I always valued my instinct. It took me time to grow into being able to put that aside and actually listen to what others have to say and what others mean and the alternative approaches, I guess, to success. And so that in itself, the 4 years of being in the Midwest, the various times I've been humbled across my career, my gosh, I would say all of that really combined to me knowing at this point, I don't need all the answers. I need to make sure I have the best people around me and the best people to do the job, whatever that job might be.
Yeah, no. And I love that it's just on the side, man. You just have a phenomenal community and a team form, you know, from your mother, like having that, you know, that wealth of experience as venture capital, like, you know, with your other parts of, you have someone that, like you said, like as you're just more direct and focused, but the other team member or your co-founder is like some more indirect, but that still places, he's still successful on his own and brings about a different energy that helps expand overall Happy Path. to the next level. So on the side, man, as HappyPath is continuing to grow and so forth, like when you look at customer adoption for your team, like what metrics are you really most focused on and improving at this stage of that? And that's question one. But the next part that leads over is, where are you seeing after kind of implementing that? Where would you like to see HappyPath in the next 6 to 12 months? As what does success look like to you?
Yeah. So I don't believe HappyPath is ready as a company nor as a product to divert from our initial goal, which is all this for implementation services. Right now, we have built a very sexy product, may I say, with an incredible engine, but it applies to a very small subset of that whole implementation services market. So what does that look like in terms of growth? I mean, the next 6 to 12 months is pedal to the metal on expand horizontally. And expanding horizontally for us is applications. So right now, we will release the best Workday testing automation platform in existence. And you have my word on that. My goal is to then take that to every platform. How do I want that a general implementer, let's take a KPMG or a Deloitte or a Capgemini, I want them to be able to come to us and us to say, we can support all of your practices, not just some of your practices. And obviously, right now, being able to even support some of their practices and drive their profit margins up, massive. But I want to be able to do this across the board. That's like step one. Step two is actually getting the exposure out to the end client, right? So I love the concept of working with consulting firms and implementation services firms, because they work as almost a fantastic distribution network where, you know, a consulting firm has 500 clients, both whether that be new implementations or existing managed services, and we can support all of that. But at the end of the day, I want to build a tool that actually achieves our original goal, which is self-testing for everyone. And maybe the way to do it is leg in with starting at all of the implementations that are going on at these end clients. And I'm going to use this, and obviously I've never talked to PepsiCo. I have no idea, but I'm going to use them as an example here. If PepsiCo is using a EY to implement Workday, which I know for a fact can't happen, but just that's why it makes a good example. I want them to be able to know about HappyPath and bring it up to their consulting firm. And then furthermore, I want to continue to build out our architecture and our engine to a point where then they can say, hey, we're also doing a cloud migration of a dozen systems that are not related to enterprise. Can we use HappyPath as well? Right. So it's starting to expand from that focus and getting that kind of dominating our niche, and then going from there to how do we actually solve this for everyone? Our end goal, the real tough one. How do we do that in an effective way? Knowing you're going to have some fallout when you expand your universe from a closed application to build anything on any platform, and this is going to be able to test it.
This is good. I'm curious on you know, as we kind of wrap up and so forth else on it. You know, when you're looking to support the partners and so forth else, like, what do you think is needed as you continue to scale, is what your customers are really looking for? And I'll expound upon that. What I mean by that is, for your team, and as you're continuing to grow, do you feel that educating your clients and kind of as it scales further, you think that's just going to come forward as they learn more about HappyPath and so forth? Or do you feel like that's going to be a struggle point?
I think educating our clients will be a struggle point in the same way, almost that we bring it back to like the beginning of our conversation when I said there are two camps. And often I find that clients are going to sit in one of those two camps. Either they're going to look at us and say, I don't believe it. Or they're going to look at this and say, well, can it do all of everything that I could ever think of wanting it to do? And kind of being able to say, hey, this is the value that it delivers. Look at it through the lens of that. So that education, definitely something. I think that I'm going to ask you to just repeat that really quickly.
Holy. No, you're good, man. You know, I really was looking for it. I guess maybe, and I'll better phrase it just on mine, like, digging deeper into how you'll train or like support your partners, like to champion the platform, you know, with that.
Absolutely. So we try to stay as involved as our clients want, to the point of being open to sit down and demos with end clients, being able to talk through and giving access to our teams when it comes to security and privacy handling, right? That's a huge piece when you're dealing with enterprises.
For sure.
And that's along with extensive documentation, support. Our goal in the initial stages, and hopefully forever, we can sustain this, is to give a white glove service where they don't feel like I just got hucked over a fence, some technology that I don't really know how to use. That's number one. But number two is actually I'm going to put my product management hat on along with the majority of my organization, which are also ex-product managers. UX is everything. Like iPhone's UX redefined the entire way we operate with phones, right? And no one really, I guess that is maybe the most used example, but it is often overlooked by people who are not in product or maybe not in technology, don't just sell technology. We built this to be as intuitive as possible. You can basically set up your entire test library and execute with like 10 clicks. And these are big, noticeable buttons. Like you're not going to miss them type thing. And then that paired with just, you know, built-in support. So not just like support from us, but once you open up the application, what do I do? Kind of having that walkthrough. That is the way we support our clients. We plan to continue to support our clients. And to be very honest, for the size and the agility to really say to any client, what do you need? And we'll be there. And that's it. And like a lot of my contracting conversations go like that. It's like, what do you need? Like, I'm not selling you a Chinese menu. I'm selling you the function of that we're going to solve your QA problems. So whatever you need to do that, we're there to do it. And that's it.
I love it, man. I love that. And then so, you know, kind of finally, you know, I always ask the, you know, the guests, you know, if you, for this, as you're continuing to scale, as you grow, not only just on Happy Path, just as a business, but even for yourself, if you had like a magic wand, like let's say, you know, ChatGPT 8 or 9 is here, you know, what would you think to utilize like AI? What would you use either to eliminate any bottlenecks right now for Happy Path or just for yourself to make it more easier? What would you like on that side?
Funny enough, it's not a intelligence issue. So I believe inherently we are going to hit a logarithmic curve in terms of the capabilities of LLMs. There is only so much marginal better that it can get based on the technology we have. There are definitely two schools of thought, and there are at least 100, if not 1,000 people that are significantly in a better position to talk about that. Specifically like the inferenceability of LLMs and how good they are. For me, it's actually more around the infra piece. I think that a huge hindrance. So first of all, I look at LLMs as just next gen compute. That's it. It's the same thing as we thought about CPUs, you know, kind of in the past. And now it's GPUs, TPUs, et cetera. So for me, I'm much more focused on the infra side of like, make it cheap. Right. And I think they did a really good job with GPT-5 on this. Everyone's like, it was a flaw. But the reality is they did it for a lot of efficiency aspects, which if you're using LLMs in an enterprise or business standpoint, you're really using it. You're not just, you know, sending through questions to get back an easy response. You're giving it complex tasks to execute through. So in that regard, from a increased TPMs, in a world where almost tokens per minute no longer exists, that would be amazing for GPT-9. In a world where all my calls are 0.00000001 of a cent, right? Where it's just dirt cheap for me to do this, I would look forward to that. Granted, I know it's probably not in the best interest of OpenAI or any of these companies, but it's in the best interest of HappyPath that all of these costs come down to essentially nothing. They become simpler. So it's great for us, but also my real reasoning behind it is that is going to be the greatest hindrance to future investment. Like the only reason these companies have such massive valuations is because people believe there's massive value on the tail end towards businesses. If you do not make it viable for businesses to build effectively and easily, and honestly, build and fail fast, you won't be able to support these incredibly high valuations and the cash flow, etc. So it's a fine balance. I am thankful I'm not Sam Altman or sitting behind OpenAI's, you know, the CFO of OpenAI and trying to make a decision on, you know, what is best for us in the future. But I do think that will be a massive leap and it will start kind of dissolving I think, a false narrative that there is no return on investment for AI. I think it's like judging computers by the third year of having computers.
Right.
You know, like there's a lot of applications you probably aren't even seeing yet, nor what can be built on this. Everyone's so focused on the source layer. No one's really focused as much on, okay, you've now opened up a whole new application layer that I feel like we being one of them, but many people are now pursuing. What will come out of that? What is the value that will be driven out? So that's what I hope to see. I hope to see cheaper, faster, with less limitations for infra.
No, and that's, and I love that because it's looking at kind of the, as you said, like people looking at a shallow versus, you know, the iceberg that sank the Titanic. Like you're only seeing so part and without seeing the larger aspect that's under the water. And I love the different approaches that you went around that looking at it from an infrastructure perspective of saving on the cost perspectives of her tokens, having it dirt cheap to be able to help alleviate for that. So I love that, you know, unique approach on you thinking of that. And I think that kind of speaks to not only just as your team, but as you, as just as a leader, founder, kind of thinking on that approach of saving on the cost and helping to alleviate. And so, Noah, this has been a great conversation, and I'm glad that you, you know, be able to take the time. Thanks for coming through. Like,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. You know, for folks that are listening, what, you know, and, you know, that are interested in like HappyPath and they're growing and wanting to know more, where can they not only find HappyPath to learn more about it, but also if they wanted to follow your journey, where could they find you?
Yeah. So, I mean, other than the, if you go to our website, happypath.io, there is a form where you can essentially give us your contact information. We'll reach out. If it's anyone that's from any kind of our target companies or target sector, we tend to reach out quite quickly. And then I would say that, you know, follow us on LinkedIn. We have a team page as well as, you know, the co-founders. We all have pretty accessible LinkedIns. And we're constantly posting. We post a lot of thought leadership that really kind of outlines what we think, both from an AI perspective, from an implementation consulting perspective, from a testing perspective. We try to take all the angles and you get to hear from everyone on the team. And then, you know, if anyone reaches out to me, I'm always happy to take, you know, have a phone conversation, chat through email. You can always find me on LinkedIn.
Perfect. Perfect, man. Well, Noah, you know, thanks again, you know, for everyone as, you know, we'll put that in to the key pieces. If you want to follow, learn more about HappyPath, if you want to see on what Noah's doing in the next couple months that they're kind of scaling on that side, love to have it. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you guys next time on the next episode.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in to the AI Advantage. If this episode sparked an idea, share it with your network. Subscribe for more No Fluff conversations on how smart tech drives real outcomes. And if you're ready to future-proof your business, let's connect at solonox.net.